This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Jill Bamberg, Dean of the MBA program at the Bainbridge Graduate Institute, an institution offering programs focused on sustainable business. Jill also has taught at Antioch University Seattle, worked in the computer software industry, and for the past 10 years has been a contributing editor and board member of the Positive Futures Network, publisher of Yes Magazine. Jill Bamberg is here today to tell us about her book, Getting to Scale, Growing Your Business Without Selling Out, published in 2006 by Barrett Kohler Publishers. Welcome, Jill.
Thank you.
What led you to write your book, Getting to Scale?
I actually got interested in this book about 5 years ago. And the specific occasion was the sale of three companies that had been sort of the poster children of the sustainable business movement. It was Ben & Jerry's, The Body Shop, and Stonyfield Farm Yogurt. And what disturbed me about that was all of these companies had reached a size where they were very significant and very well known in the public's mind, you know, as in fact banner children for this business, and all of a sudden they sold out. And I began to wonder if maybe there was something fundamentally wrong with the idea of socially responsible business that made it impossible for companies that carried that banner to survive past a certain size. So I began to be interested in that question. At about the same time, there was a lot of interest in the local living economies movement and the idea that local was a solution to some of the business problems of larger businesses. And that didn't seem quite right to me either, because I was worried that if all of the people who were trying to do good things were just focused on their local markets, that there would be this huge amount of business that was being done by people who didn't care. And how could those businesses grow to reach a size where they could fill that gap? So it was kind of coming from both ends of the spectrum.
What criteria did you use to choose the business owners that you interviewed for your book?
I ended up interviewing about 30 different people, and I wanted a range of industries. That was really important to me because I wanted to make sure that this wasn't a phenomenon that could only occur in certain industries. So that range was important. Second thing that was important was I wanted them to actually have achieved some level of success over time and actually have grown significantly. There's quite a range in the book of those things. And I think the third criteria was I wanted to make sure that the founders were still involved with the business and had actually been through the growth period so that I had sort of a continuous record of the challenges that the companies had faced through their growth cycle.
Could you give us some examples from your book of the different types of businesses and their missions?
Sure. They're all over the map. And again, that was one of my selection criteria. Some that were particularly inspiring to me. I really like a company up in Vancouver, B.C. called Spud for Small Potatoes Urban Delivery, which is an urban grocery delivery service that only carries organic food and actually forges a link between local consumers and local producers. That's a very exciting story. At the other end of the spectrum, there's a guy in Nashville, Tennessee, who's running a real estate company that I greatly admire, where he focused his business on developing a vibrant downtown Nashville and not contributing to suburban sprawl. And then he's built the business so that a percentage of all of the transaction fees that are associated with a real estate sale all go into a community foundation that benefits the larger community. Other industries, there's a toy company in here, an apparel manufacturer that's based in the United States, a hemp manufacturer up in Canada, not in the United States, of course. Some people who are doing business internationally and helping to make interesting entrepreneurial businesses happen in the developing world. It's really all over the map.
What kind of level of financial success have these businesses attained at this point?
I think they are all profitable at this point, for sure. The size range is from about, I think, $3 million in sales is probably the smallest one, to over $250 million in sales. There may be somebody bigger than that, but that's the biggest that I recall. So it's quite a range. I don't think there's any billion-dollar companies in this sample.
Why grow a business larger? What's wrong with remaining small?
Another good question. There's kind of a small is beautiful, you know, argument to be made. And I think those businesses are absolutely fine. And they tend to support people in the lifestyle that they want to be accustomed to. And they're even referred to now as lifestyle businesses. And I think they're great. The issue is that if you want to have a larger impact on the world and move it it in the direction that you think is appropriate, you need to be able to scale up frequently. So these are people who have consciously chosen to have a larger impact by growing their business. The other thing, that's there's a quote in the book from a person in the New Community Corporation based in Newark, New Jersey, where they've essentially revitalized parts of the inner city there. And the quote is that small isn't beautiful if the problems that you're trying to address are big.
What reasons did the entrepreneurs you interviewed give for wanting to make their businesses larger?
In general, almost across the board, it wasn't about money, which is the standard reason that people want to grow their businesses larger. It was really in almost all cases that they had figured out a way to do business that was good for the planet and good for the people that were working for them and good for their customers and was in general contributing on balance to the greater good of the world, and they wanted to do more of that.
What are the main challenges for socially responsible businesses as they grow larger?
Well, the biggest one that you have to talk about right away is money. In order to grow, you have to have capital for the most part. You have to have capital ahead of sales, which means that that capital has to come from someplace. One of the recommendations of the book that came across loud and clear was don't attract a lot of outside capital. If you can, grow based on your own sales. So bootstrap your way into the next level of operation. On the other hand, that's not always possible. And so people do have to go out for money. And that's where it begins to get tricky, because traditional investors have a set of expectations about the amount of their financial return and the timing of that return that aren't necessarily supported by this kind of a business. So one of the biggest challenges is finding appropriate investment capital to fund these kinds of businesses. Other challenges are the same challenges that you would face in any kind of a growing business, which is maintaining the culture and the spirit of the business as you bring in more and more people. So those kinds of issues turn out to be pretty critical. I think those are the most challenging, probably.
What are some of the solutions that your entrepreneurs came up with to deal with these issues?
In general, they were very, very thoughtful. On the culture and the people side, all of them emphasize the importance of managing the culture, managing the values fit, and particularly the importance of hiring carefully. And there's a tendency when you're small to take anybody who's willing to work for you at the rate of pay that you can pay. And what all these companies had been through was they had done some of that kind of hiring and had lived past the stage of surviving it and regretting it. And their recommendations on balance were hire very, very, very carefully and manage that piece of things. On the financing side, there's a couple of different approaches. One is to find investors who are, in fact, interested in the same values that you are, and there are several sources for people like that. And then the other is to bootstrap so that you don't have to bring in outside investors at all. Another possibility is to build the business to a certain level using your own savings and assets and then borrow money from the bank rather than take in equity investors who will help to control the direction of your business. So, and then beyond that, there are some sort of clever instruments that various people have devised to raise money from outside investors. So it's a wide range of solutions.
Are certain types of businesses harder to maintain as socially responsible or mission-driven?
That's definitely true. And one of the things that I do in one of the chapters is lay out a sort of a spectrum of what makes it easier or harder to maintain this kind of a focus. And I think the hardest company that I looked at is actually the toy manufacturer. And that's largely because that business is so competitive and it is so dominated by big players that it's very hard to get your cost structure down to a point where you can compete successfully and hang on to all of your values, particularly in this case, they're part of the company's values, this is Wild Planet Toys, was no guns and no Barbies. And it turns out that their great ideas about a non-sexist line of toys were difficult to play out in the marketplace, because the first thing that you notice if you go into a toy store is it's completely gender-driven. So over time, they've had to adapt their message in the marketplace to face those kinds of realities. So I think theirs has been one of the toughest journeys, and it has to do with the competitiveness. Any time that you can charge a price premium or otherwise differentiate yourself in a way that the marketplace values, you have a little bit of extra cash to play with, which can be applied to maintaining your mission, and that's one of the things that makes it easier.
Could you now tell us about Project Impact and its special characteristics in terms of a business model?
Yeah, that is a wonderful, wonderful story. There's a fellow named David Green who's been recognized as an Ashoka Fellow. Ashoka is a foundation that honors social entrepreneurs around the world. And his particular business is, well, Project Impact is a multifaceted business based in the United States, but his particular success has been with a cataract hospital in India and the manufacturing company that actually makes the intraocular lenses that are used in cataract surgery. And what he essentially did was reverse engineer this entire process of both manufacturing the lenses and doing that, performing that surgery. And he took it from a small-scale, very expensive operation at the time that he started and made it a mass phenomenon. And he did it in several different ways. One, he realized that a lot of the cost of making intraocular lenses was not truly involved in the manufacturing process. So he just drilled down in the manufacturing process until he got it to absolutely the bare minimum requirements. And he, the company that he started is now one of the major suppliers in the entire world, and certainly in the developing world, making these lenses available to people at pennies on the dollar of what they cost traditionally. What he also did was take the eye operation surgery and turn that into sort of a mass production kind of a system so that he's able to put many, many, many people through this surgery every day of the week. And the model that he started in India, he's now spread to other countries around the world and is looking at performing similar kinds of approaches to other kinds of health problems, ranging from hearing aids, which is a similar project, to HIV education in Africa. He is he's also been recognized with a MacArthur Genius Award and is just, you know, a wonderful human being doing great work.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Jill Bamberg, Dean of the MBA program at the Bainbridge Graduate Institute, an institution offering programs in sustainable business. Our topic is Jill Bamberg's book, Getting to Scale, Growing Your Business Without Selling Out. In your book, you describe a variety of different forms or types of organizations, all the way from publicly traded corporations to nonprofits. Overall, is there a particular form or type of organization that works best if a company has a social or environmental mission?
Yeah, I think one of the findings of the research was that almost any form can work. The one that is most problematic is clearly the publicly traded company. And there, particularly if you have institutional investors holding your shares, there's this whole question about whether they can in fact vote for issues, vote in favor of activities that don't necessarily, quote, maximize shareholder wealth in the short term. So it's difficult to maintain that focus in a publicly traded company, although we found a couple of examples, most notably Bright Horizons. It's a company that provides child care in corporate settings, Bright Horizons Family Solutions. Anyway, so they're a publicly traded company that has made this possible, and the Body Shop did it for a while, actually, and so did Ben & Jerry's for a while. At the other end of the spectrum, there are a large number of nonprofit organizations that are now looking for revenue generation opportunities and are beginning to run businesses like this. One of the models that I am most interested in personally is actually the franchise model. And the example that's cited in the book is of Great Harvest Bread Company out of Montana, where they've built a franchise system as a learning community so that all of their operations are locally owned, but all of the people who are in the system learn from each other's success and help each other out. And I think that's a model that has a lot of potential.
Could you say a bit more about nonprofit businesses and what their challenges and strengths are?
There's a fair amount of sort of form envy on both sides of this equation. The nonprofits tend to be jealous of the people in the for-profit sector because of their ability to have access to the capital markets. The for-profit companies tend to be jealous of the nonprofits' ability to have a tax exemption and to attract donations and so on. In terms of actually running a business, the nonprofits have some specific issues. One is that they're not necessarily trained to think like business people, and so they don't necessarily have that hard edge about customer service and competition that some of the for-profit brethren do. The advantage that they bring, I think, is a certain amount of cleverness and innovation, a very deep understanding of the client populations that they've served historically. And if they can translate that into a deep understanding of customers, I think that they can do some significant things. The advantages to nonprofits that are looking at this is obviously it reduces their dependency on individual donors, foundations, and government grants, all of which are an ongoing problem for nonprofits to maintain that kind of support.
Could you tell us the story of American Apparel?
That's a very interesting company. They're based down in Los Angeles. They are now the largest U.S.-based apparel company. And one of the reasons for that is that everybody else in the textile business has kind of given up. They believe that they have to go offshore in order to be competitive. And at American Apparel, they absolutely believe that's not the case, and they set out to prove that. In fact, they have probably the highest paid garment worker labor force of any company in the world. And establishing the ability to make garments in the United States is an important part of their mission. That's absolutely what they're committed to. And what they found is that the advantages of that are for their business model in the sector that they're in, which is very fashion forward, they can respond to the marketplace instantly. And they're in a youth marketplace. And so if something is hot today, they can have 3,000 versions of it off the workshop by the end of the day and onto the truck. So they're able to be much more responsive than somebody who's got a long supply chain going offshore. They're also able to get some cost savings in the way in which they've organized their manufacturing in terms of cells that are working on the various garments instead of working on them in an assembly line, which was the traditional way of organizing this kind of labor. And then the way they compensate their employees is on a team piecework basis. So instead of individual piecework, it's group piecework. But having done that, they are now able to offer the highest wages in the industry, in excess of $12 an hour.
Are there additional examples that you personally found particularly inspiring and or informative?
Yeah, I mean, I found every single story interesting and inspiring. I loved the people that I talked to, and I love what they're doing and was just inspired over and over again. I think the story of the organization in Newark, New Jersey was particularly moving to me. And there, the organization called New Community Corporation was founded in the aftermath of the Newark riots in 1967. And they basically started with nothing except the ideas of a parish priest and a handful of community leaders. And out of that, they have built a multi-million-dollar business that now provides housing and health care and education and job training and everything for that community. And it's a phenomenal story and a very inspiring one.
Did you find any common personal characteristics of the owners of successful, socially responsible businesses?
Geez, common characteristics. One would be their commitment to their mission. I mean, that's the thing that distinguishes this group of entrepreneurs from other groups of entrepreneurs. And all of these people were deeply, deeply committed to doing good work in the world. I think the second thing that distinguishes them from other types of idealists is that they were also extremely pragmatic and by the end of their runs, very good business people. So they understood the realities and the difficulties of making it in business. They had honed their survival instincts and been able to do that while maintaining this commitment to their mission. And I think that's a pretty unusual breed of cat.
Overall, to what extent is the ability of the companies you examine to stay true to their mission a function of the personality of the founder as opposed to the structure of the company that was set up?
Wow. For starters, my sample was biased towards firms where the founder had stayed in place. And many companies outgrow their founders and need to move on. So I think in all cases, probably the founder was fairly critical to these. But what the founder had done was pay attention to structuring the business in such a way that the values would permeate the firm. So I think there was a real strong desire to not have these businesses be a cult of personality or just be built around one individual. I think these people were remarkably less ego-driven than many entrepreneurs.
example, have companies that have grown while staying true to their mission tended to treat their employees?
Most of the companies in this sample did pretty well. I would say that that is not always the case. And one of the issues is sometimes companies are so busy doing good work in the world that they believe their primary benefit to employees is offering them an opportunity to be part of this wonderful mission. This happens in nonprofits a lot as well, obviously. And so there's sometimes a tendency to, if not exploit a labor force, at least sort of take it for granted or say, geez, we'll reach a certain level and then we'll put in the employee benefits. That wasn't so true in these companies. Mm-hmm. They, by and large, tried to treat their employees as well as they could given the business realities. And in some cases, most notably a case of a nursery up in Vermont, one of the things that was driving them to get to scale was a desire to be able to pay their employees better and offer a more complete benefits package. And until they reached a certain size and level of profitability, they just weren't able to do that.
Do you think the way they treat their employees has been instrumental in the success of these businesses?
Well, I certainly think the commitment of their employees has been instrumental to their success. And part of that commitment is driven by, tangible benefits, but a much greater part of it is driven by the intangible benefit of having an opportunity to do something that's meaningful and important.
The companies you evaluated had grown well beyond mom-and-pop organizations, but none are the size of General Motors. Do you think companies could grow to that size and still maintain a socially responsible mission?
I would say at least theoretically that's true. The issue, again, comes back to financing, which is to grow to that size, you probably have to become a publicly traded company and you probably have to raise significant amounts of money from traditional investors. And so the question is, are we at a point where traditional investors are willing to either take a slower payback or a slightly lower return in order to support these ventures in the world? Now, that's one way of looking at it. The other, and potentially more interesting, is what are the sectors of the economy where work needs to be done going forward that represent opportunities to make significant contribution to the world and at the same time generate significant financial returns? And the one that pops to the top of everybody's list right now is renewable energy. So you can imagine a company that was devoted to making renewables work, which is certainly a socially responsible mission, being run in a socially responsible way and generating fabulous returns for investors. So, I think that the future may be different than the past on this one.
If a small socially responsible business is considering whether or not to grow, what advice would you give?
Well, I asked some questions at the end of the book, and the first one is, what defines success for you? So I think to some extent this is a really personal issue. How big do you have to be to do the work that you want to do in the world? And some people will decide to stay small, and some people will decide to stay local, and some people will make, all kinds of choices. And the important thing is that that be the right choice for them. So I think that's the first question. And then a second question is, how big do you need to be in order to have the impact that you want to have on the world? And if people are interested in having impact at the community level, which is totally wonderful, they may be able to do that by staying at a certain size. If they want to have impact at the global level, they're probably going to have to get bigger. And then I think the third question that I encourage people to ask is, how big does the business have to be in order to be successful as a business? Because there is such a thing as economies of scale, and there are certain scale advantages that you have to address one way or the other.
What were some of the common themes you found among the socially responsible businesses?
The biggest common theme was that this is possible. And I think that's not necessarily obvious to everyone. So I think that was one big theme. Another big theme was that there's real joy in this work. Business is hard, and small business is particularly hard, and growing a business is hard. But because these people were fired up about what they were trying to do for the world, there was a lot of joy along the way. And I think beyond that, these people ended up being smart, savvy business people. And I can't emphasize that enough. I teach a lot of idealistic students, and I teach them about business. And one of the things that we try to pound into their heads is that, you know, business is really hard, and you have to be willing to make tough decisions and very practical decisions and not let your idealism get in the way of the requirements of survival.
Would you like to say a few words about the Bainbridge Graduate Institute?
Well, I'd love to. That's my other great passion in life at this point. The Bainbridge Graduate Institute is about 5 years old. We're fielding our fifth group of students. We've grown from 10 students 5 years ago to over 100 now. I think that we are generally considered the front runner in the field of sustainable business education. And a recent survey of the students of Net Impact, which is a student association of socially responsible business students, voted our school number one in the entire country in terms of student satisfaction with the program. Our goal is to change the world by changing the way the world does business. So it's not a small goal. And our short-term strategy, at least, is to create one of the most interesting, innovative business school programs going today. So I would love to talk more about that. And if any of your listeners are interested, I would encourage them to go out to our website and take a look. It's the Bainbridge Graduate Institute.
What's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think the message is that doing business in an environmentally and socially responsible way is totally possible, and that people who are looking either as young people or as people at midlife in trying to find work that is more aligned with their personal values need to take that task seriously and think seriously about the opportunities of actually starting one of these kinds of businesses. I think the book is inspiring and instructive, or at least I hope it is, and I hope that we'll see a lot more of this kind of activity.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Okay, thank you very much. Great questions.
We have just been speaking with Jill Bamberg, Dean of the MBA program at the Bainbridge Graduate Institute, and author of the book, Getting to Scale, Growing Your Business Without Selling Out, published in 2006 by Barrett Kohler Publishers. For more information, check on the web at www.bgiedu.org. Again, that's bgiedu.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are now available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters Sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week.